Thank you very much, Martin Wilkinson. It's now time to enter the Q&A portion of the presentation. I've got some that have been submitted here from the British Medical Journal News, so I'm going to kick off with that, and then I will unmute the participants, and we'll go from there. So to start out, this is a question for Bob Elliott. Why is it that islet cells from human donors can't be used to treat people with diabetes?
Well, it'd be a nice idea, but there, for instance, in New Zealand, with current organ procurement from cadaver donors, we'd have enough to do six patients a year, which is a drop in the bucket. That really precludes it being a serious attempt to treat this disease. I mean, it's going to be just for a handful of people. It has been done elsewhere, using immunosuppression rather than microencapsulation. So the whole problem there is, firstly, the availability of tissue. The second one is, if there's a double whammy with type 1 diabetes, it's not just ordinary rejection. It's actually recurrence of the original disease in the person. That's an immune reaction. Autoimmune disease, and human islets are destroyed by the immune system. So it's a double whammy, just the ordinary rejection and also a destruction process by autoimmunity. But the main problem is just the lack of availability of towards the 20 million type 1 diabetics in the world. We'd never get anywhere near enough that way.
And a follow-up question as well, which is, has the transplantation of islet cells into humans ever previously taken place? And if so, what were the results?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Has the type of research that you've been doing, the transplantation of xenotransplantation of islet cells, been carried out anywhere else in the world? And if so, what were the results?
There have been attempts with various different systems. There was one in Mexico that was done some years ago, which had rather indeterminate results. There have been other animal tissues used, rabbits, as the source of islets, with, again, no clear cut result. There are other groups forming up right now, and one in particular in Minnesota, and another one in London, Ontario, another group in Belgium, who are very interested in taking somewhat different approaches to it to the one we are. But it's happening.
Thank you. All right. Kent Atkinson from the NZPA, New Zealand Press Association, you've submitted several questions. Would you like to go ahead with one of them? Kent, are you there? All right, we'll move on to...
Sorry, I think I was on mute.
Okay, there you go. Go ahead, Kent.
I apologize for that. I sent the questions in by on the electronic chat session earlier. One I was interested in was for Professor Elliott. He's made a big deal in previous publicity that the herd has been isolated from multiple livestock disease for 300 years. I wonder to what extent this is actually false reasoning, because the pigs from which LCT drew its foundation herd were actually released from quarantine in early 2000 and held for the Rare Breed Society. It was some years before LCT picked them up. In the meantime, they were running with other livestock and presumably exposed to modern diseases.
Yeah, well, that's not true. There were pigs released from the original lot into the general animal community, and they still are. They're in zoos and turn up at farm shows and so on. But our pigs went through quarantine and went straight into another facility in Invercargill from that quarantine facility. They were never mixed with the general animal population. And they were tested in that new facility and found to be free of infection there. Then some were transferred to a higher class facility in Auckland. So it's not true that these pigs have run around with other animals, but any, not the ones we're using. Yeah, there are other pigs out there out from the Auckland Islands.
Do you plan to have more pigs captured this summer to go straight into quarantine again?
Probably not this summer. We won't have the accommodation for them ready. It's a very expensive, these special facilities. We've just set one up in another one in Invercargill for 50 animals, and it's cost us $2.5 million. We're limited at the moment with the accommodation, but there are some hundreds of animals still present on the Auckland Islands, which we have our eye on for the future, to keeping some genetic freshness going.
Would you have any objection to DOC making animals available from the islands to other researchers and other clinical companies which are looking at either the same kind of work you're doing or other forms of xenotransplants from pigs to humans?
We have a very good relationship with DOC, which at the moment gives us a sort of first rights on these animals. We can't go any further than that, except to say that that is the position that DOC said. If any animals are coming off, they're going to us at least for the foreseeable future. There are plans to destroy all of the animals on the island, since they pose some sort of environmental hazard to fauna and flora on those islands.
But surely if other researchers or other clinical companies were willing to pay for the costs of extracting the animals, the 1,500 left on the islands, you shouldn't be attempting to block their access to those animals.
Commercially, of course we are. Yes, yeah, we're not too many people trying the same thing, but it's actually a theoretical thing, because first of all, they have to be kept for at least 3 years in a suitable sterile environment, fed no animal protein, tested regularly during that time. So if anybody did go down there and get some, they've got a three-year wait before they could use the animals.
Right. One last issue on the pigs. If you're killing the piglets anyway for the udder cells, what scope is there to use other parts of the same pigs for other transplants, such as brain choroid plexus cells, veins or even bones or other tissue?
Yeah, well, there's hundreds of applications that could be tried. We're trying brain choroid plexus cells, we've tried liver cells, there are many other cell types that we could use, just using even the tissues themselves, the collagen, non-living tissue collagen, and that sort of thing. We're pushing hard on that. We'll use them all up in the fullness of time. Yeah.
All right, thanks very much, Kent. There's a question from Susan Kirk. Does that cover the question that you asked, or did you want to follow up?
No, I think that covers it. I don't think there was mention of how many pigs will be needed, or how many tasks the pigs be used. Sorry, I'm a freelance journalist from Brisbane.
Yes. Okay, well, that's pretty simple. One sow produces enough newborn piglets. We use newborn piglets. We don't destroy the sow. Enough for about one patient for one xenotransplant per year. So you can see we'll need an awful lot of pigs if we ever get round to doing 20 million type 1 diabetics. But, of course, it won't happen that way. It'll be we have clinical trials to do first. There's a long build-up period. But that's about the numbers. One cell produce enough piglets to provide enough cells for one patient per year.
Right. I'll open the floor now. Are there other questions for journalists who've dialed in? Please state your name and your organization.
Yeah, I have a question for Professor DiPicci. My name's Ruth Hill. I'm a reporter with the Dominion Post newspaper in Wellington. Professor Elliott, what he was saying before, he felt that regulatory authorities that were holding back on approval for these clinical trials, you know, huge could actually be. What was the phrase he used?
Moratorium.
That were holding tight to the moratorium. That could be failing on their clinical duty to patients. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the I guess that's a sort of slightly emotive thing at this stage, but in Australia, what's happening is that the NHMRC about 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, imposed a moratorium, basically saying that they didn't think there was enough information on either efficacy, in other words, would it work, or on safety, to warrant allowing clinical trials. Now, that was a 5-year moratorium which would expire December 31 this year, or thereabouts. And the NHMRC, and a lot of water has passed under the bridge in 5 years, including a much greater understanding of the risk. At that time, there was a lot of heat and anxiety about this porcine endogenous retrovirus, which had been relatively recently before that discovered and was thought to potentially pose an enormous risk, even to the point of being sufficient to shut down any possibility of xenotransplantation proceeding to the clinic. And so companies fled the field in droves. But the passage of time has shown that porcine endogenous retrovirus is largely in the order of a theoretical risk. It's one of these things where you cannot say never, in other words, that there is no risk, but there is no evidence of a risk other than the possibility that there might be. So that nobody has ever been infected with porcine endogenous retrovirus, nobody's developed disease from it. So that we've come to learn over the years. In addition, research has continued, such as Bob Elliott's, which has suggested that there may be benefit and that we're getting closer to a point where you might say it's going to work. Now, we in the International Xenotransplant Association rely heavily on preclinical trials to get that data. We do not believe that Bob Elliott has sufficient preclinical data to support a clinical trial, and we've said that on many occasions. Nevertheless, the New Zealand government has decided that they feel that there is enough.
What would you be looking for more?
We would like to see success in primates, picked primate studies, and that hasn't been forthcoming. So we would not, if we were a regulatory authority, we would have said, well, we wouldn't approve it, but we're not. We're an advisory authority. We offered our advice, and our advice was we don't believe there's enough preclinical evidence to warrant a clinical trial. That's fine. The New Zealand government's a sovereign authority, and it makes its decisions based on what it sees fit. And it has done so, and I wish Bob good luck. I hope that it works very well. I mean, I don't want to see a failure. But the point about in Australia is that they have yet to decide whether to go ahead with allowing clinical trials. Now, saying that they might allow a clinical trial also means that they've got to have in place a regulatory authority, some government group capable of and with a mandate for regulating it. New Zealand has established such an authority to look after, you know, POTS trial and other trials. They will oversight and manage. That is still to be done in Australia, and it would be one of the things that would have to be in place when a moratorium finished before a clinical trial could commence. Even if you said the moratorium's gone, well, then the next step is how do you regulate it and so forth. So that's where we're at. I think that the NHMRC is actively looking at this process and will come to a conclusion sometime later in this year about it.
Sorry, I don't want to hog the floor, but can I just ask Professor Elliott about that? How come we haven't had those primates?
Well, we did a primate study which demonstrated statistically significant benefit. We got only one of eight animals off insulin. We think the primate, the model is severely flawed and could be misleading in both directions. We decided that rather than wasting a lot more time and killing a lot more primates off, which is in itself an unethical procedure, I mean, primate research in New Zealand is banned, and it seemed to us that it was wrong to continue beyond where we had a statistically significant response to a small study to go on doing more studies in primates. So that's the position here, is that we think it's a bad model, and it isn't a model at all, actually, of type 1 diabetes, and that we were just wasting time, money, and primates on doing further research along that line.
All right, thank you very much, Ruth. Open the floor to another question.
Ken Atkinson at NZPF. I could just follow that up. How should the government enforce lifelong monitoring of xenograft recipients, their sexual partners and other close contacts, and having that be done without infringing the Bill of Rights and the Disabilities Code, which would allow them to withdraw from patients to withdraw their consent to such monitoring at any time they wanted?
Well, yeah, that's perfectly true. You can't police this. That's perfectly true. People are only enlisted into the trial if they agree to that. So they're going back on a written agreement. But people can do that. So what are you going to do with them if they do? The other practical way we've got around this, of course, is by pre-selecting people who we know won't back off on this situation. Reliable souls. And they're very highly selected, obviously, with this very small study we're doing. And don't forget, diabetics are used to monitoring. They monitor themselves many times per day, and it's not an arduous task for them or their families to put up with monitoring, which becomes quite infrequent further down the track, like once every 5 years, which isn't a big deal.
All right, thanks, Kent. Other questions?
Hi, it's Martha White from New Zealand Geographic here. Question for Bob Elliott. Can I just ask two in quick succession, because I think they're fairly straightforward. The first one is, how many diabetics actually volunteered for this trial? And secondly, I understand there's a lot of compatibility between pigs and humans in terms of organs, tissues, cells, etc. But if you had another disease-free population of any other animal, is there any other animal that you could achieve similar results from?
Okay. The first thing, number of volunteers, well over 1,000. I mean, the farm goes every day with people wanting to be part of an eight-subject trial. It's just enormous, the numbers. And we've selected out of those a smaller group who have desirable characteristics, like they live close by and can follow the trial protocols. There's a lot of exclusions, age, other conditions and so on. So we, out of that lot, we selected, say, 20 or 30, and then that's got to be honed down further to eight. No, your second question was, sorry, was the...
Is there any other animal that...
Rabbits have been used, but much, much less is known about rabbit diseases. At least, although pigs do have diseases that can be definitely transmitted to man, we tended to know about those because we've lived cheek by jowl with pigs for many millennia, and we're aware of those diseases, whereas rabbits have been unknown... quantity. Primates would be closer than pigs, but there are a huge number of problems associated with primates. I mean, there is a very real chance, because they're so similar to us, that they could hand on retroviral diseases. They have in the past with AIDS, and their diseases are more likely to be transmitted to man than pig diseases. The difference in species pretty much assures that many of the viruses are incapable, the pig viruses are incapable of infecting man. Obviously not all.
Sort of cows, pigs, sheep?
Yeah, well, sheep, I suppose. Well, the problem with sheep is they don't run the same blood glucose as us, and it would be fairly disastrous, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Margot. Are there other questions from the floor?
Yeah, I have a question here. It's Danny Rose from Australian Associated Press, and I'm just asking in terms of the lifting of the moratorium, and maybe this is a question for Anthony, but how much does the swine flu lend weight to those who would oppose the lifting of this moratorium? Does it play any role? Will it play any role in the public debate on this? And I guess, are you confident that the moratorium will be lifted?
First of all, about swine flu. Well, the answer is I'm sure it'll be introduced into the debate, but it is illogical to do so. I mean, if you ask Bob how his animals are isolated and so forth, you'll know that these animals are maintained in strict isolation, and even if they did perchance develop the infection, then they clear it, and you know they remain in isolation. So the point about the requirements for managing these pigs is that you keep them in strict isolation and rid them of all transmissible diseases that we know of, and that you do this by testing them to make sure that they don't have them. And so that's part of the process. So swine flu is not really relevant. I guess the other thing is that, just understanding flu, is that all the flus are circulate through, if you like, humans, pigs, birds, with varying degrees of residence in the populations, and so that any flu has probably got the potential to pass through any of those populations. Now, the other question about am I confident about the moratorium, I guess I'm optimistic. I think things have changed, and I think good sense would see the moratorium go. I don't want to ramp up pressure or anything about it. I think it'll... the HMRC in its wisdom will consider this carefully, and I think we'll move on. That's about all I'd like to say about it.
And Bob, would that see any of your work done shifted from New Zealand to Australia?
Oh yeah, I mean it's a very convenient place. It's a 3-hour plane trip. That's all. And yeah, we would certainly be looking for that if the moratorium is lifted, which, it has stands a fair pass. So Anthony's quite right. There's a lot of things have happened in the last 5 years, and the one that is most dominant is the lessening of the fear about transmission of pig endogenous retrovirus. It hasn't happened, and and people have really been trying to make it happen experimentally, and just really totally failed to do so in real life. So, I mean, that will weigh heavily, I'm sure, with the NHMRC in Australia. And if they do say, yeah, the moratorium's lifted, yes, we do actually comply with all of the requirements of everybody except having more robust primate results, non-human primate results. But we're going to have robust human primate results, if you like, in the very short-term future. So I think that will, again, in a very short time, a year or two, become very apparent which way it's going. So, yeah, we would certainly be wanting to shift across the ditch.
All right. Thank you, Danny.
The Associated Press for Les Reliot, say 8 subjects had began implants today.
Yeah.
How soon will the full group have their implants, Bob?
It's a pretty slow build-up. We have to do a 2-month period of observation, establishing baselines and that sort of thing, and making sure people really do want to hear that. It's got to be more than just consent. It's got to be, they've got to be there and understand that this is a very arduous trial and that they might want to pull out after a month or so. We did the first patient, transplant the first patient about 2 months' time. Then we wait for some months following that before we do the second one. It speeds up a bit towards the end, but we're taking it very, very slowly. One of the things that we're required to add in rather at the last minute was that we're dealing with diabetics who are not coping well with their current treatment, having problems despite trying hard in both directions. Blood sugar's too high and too low and getting into difficulty. So that's been added in. These are unstable type 1 diabetics that we'll be dealing with.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ray. We'll have time for, to start to wind things up, I think, one more question. Any takers for the final question?
Thank you.
All right. Well, then that will conclude our...
Well, if nobody else is going to take it, I'll step in if I could.
Okay.
It's Kent Atkinson here at NZPA. I'm just intrigued by the prospect, how far along its research LCT is in terms of offering treatments for Parkinson's or strokes or other brain problems, particularly with the cord plexus material. Does intend to have human trials on those either here or in the United States?
Okay, well, we're at the preclinical level here in small animals only. Rats are only one in primates. That was Huntington's disease. We are proceeding to primate studies for Parkinson's, hopefully pretty soon. But we have to do those primate studies first because here the injection is directly into the brain, and we need to establish the safety of that procedure in primates. So we're some years off yet being able to offer that even for a clinical trial.
So it might effectively need ministerial approval to do primate studies in New Zealand. Are you looking at conducting those in a more favourable environment as the United States? Or?
Yeah. We have a suitable unit that's done a lot of primate work with a pretty good model of Parkinson's disease, and we're just really awaiting some funding to get that contract underway.
And you're looking to the commercialisation of the diabetes product for that funding?
Yeah, I mean, that's what might happen first, you know, and maybe follow sequentially. I mean, it all depends. I mean, we're very much at the mercy of our shareholders. We don't draw large charitable grants or government grants.
Do you see a day when you may have as many as 80 or 100 piggeries around New Zealand providing pigs for these types of procedures?
Oh, if it all goes well and we get good results out of this first trial, yeah, that will be the sort of numbers we're looking for. Yeah.
Great. All right. Thank you very much to our panelists, Associate Professor Martin Wilkinson, Professor Anthony Dapatee, and Professor Bob Elliott.